Welcome to See Hear Speak podcast, episode 54. In this episode, I speak with Leah Kappa about her work on executive functioning in young children with developmental language disorder. Importantly, she defines executive functioning and describes how it is measured along with the impact of her findings for both theory and practice. After listening to this episode, don't forget to check out the website, www.seehearspeakpodcast.com, to sign up for email alerts for new episodes and content, read a transcript of the podcast, access articles and resources that we discussed, and find more information about our guests. Speaking of resources, I'm still working to get those updated, so be patient, and I will have those to you as soon as I can. In the meantime, if you hear about something you want to learn more, then just send me an email. Thank you so much. Welcome to See Hear Speak podcast, episode 54. Today, I have Leah Kappa, and I will have her start by introducing herself.
Hi, Tiffany. Thank you so much for inviting me to be here today. I'm a fan of the podcast, so now I'm having kind of a fangirl moment to get to talk with you today, and I'm excited to talk about my work. My name is Leah Kappa, and I'm an assistant professor of speech, language, and hearing sciences at the University of Arizona and the director of the Language and Cognition Lab here.
Fantastic. I'm so glad to have you. We've talked about some of the areas that we're going to discuss today, but we haven't really put them together. So your primary lines of inquiry are the study of executive function in young children with developmental language disorder. So to get us started, I thought we would first check in with some definitions. So if you could explain to the audience what you mean by executive function, and how do you test this in children with developmental language disorder? And if you're already going into definitions, then I'll also ask you to please remind everyone what you mean by developmental language disorder and how are you assessing it in young children?
So these are all really important questions because different researchers can use different definitions of all of these things. So it's important to make sure everybody understands the particular definition that I'm working from, because it does kind of frame the work and the approaches that we take. So in terms of executive function, I think of executive function as a group of cognitive skills that are used to direct attention and then modify behavior, essentially. And so the models that I work from kind of have separable components of executive function. Other people think of it as a unitary construct, but I think of it as separate components that are related to each other, but that we can measure separately. So that informs then the types of measures that I use. And the main components of executive function, typically defined in the literature and the ones that I use, are working memory, so the ability to hold information in mind over a short period, but also manipulate that information, which sets it apart a little bit from short-term memory, which is really just the holding of the information. And an example of a way that we would test that in young children is with a span task that's a backward span task. So for example, giving them a list of kind of simple monosyllabic words to remember, but then saying them back to us in the reverse order. So in that way, we're tapping into the short-term memory. Could they remember the list of words, but also that manipulation? Can they reorder them to make them backwards?
I'll just stop you real quick because I'm wondering, I'm going to throw myself on the sword here a little bit. So that would look like if you asked me, could you think of like four words to tell me and then I'll say them backwards?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So what would four words could you tell me and I'll say them backwards?
So an example of this would be if I gave you the list of words, dog, spoon, shoe, key, and then you said those to me in the backwards order, so starting with key.
Key, shoe, spoon, dog.
Exactly. And so in that way, you might have noticed your own experience of doing that. It kind of was tapping into both having to remember what the list of words was, but then you had this additional cognitive effort of thinking about the order and then reversing it.
Oh, that was okay. Great. Fantastic. Okay.
So a second component that most executive function models would include is inhibition, which is also sometimes called inhibitory control. And so this has a couple of different facets to it. One, I would describe as being able to ignore irrelevant information. And another related, but you could measure it in a separate way, aspect of inhibition is the ability to avoid making your kind of automatic but wrong response. So kind of avoiding knee-jerk responses. So a frequently used measure of inhibition in both children and adults would be a flanker task, for example. And here we're participants are seeing rows of arrows, and their goal is to focus on the direction of the center arrow, which sometimes has arrows on either side of it that are pointing in the same direction, which doesn't require inhibition because you can look at any arrow and get the correct response. But other times the central target arrow is pointing in the opposite direction of the flankers. So that creates that need for inhibition. You have to ignore the flankers and focus on the target. And so that would be a visual example of how to do that. And at this point, I think I should also mention that I've given a verbal example of a working memory task, a visual example of an inhibition measure, and all these components can be measured in different modalities. So we have kind of verbal and nonverbal equivalents, trying to tap into the same underlying construct, which is important when you're working with populations with language impairment and you're trying to tease apart the effects of the language impairment on their performance versus an underlying cognitive system. So we'll circle back to that, but I wanted to explain that my examples are a little bit different there.
I'm glad you said that because I've done some work myself with, as you know, with Mary Alt and
yes.
Arizona and Shelley Gray. And uh-huh. We also tried to make sure we had, you know, verbal and nonverbal approaches to different working memory construct. Because like, as you said, you know, measuring working memory only in verbal when a hallmark characteristic of developmental language disorder is verbal difficulty, that's really not getting maybe the best performance, right?
From exactly, exactly. Then it's very hard to tease apart, is this an underlying executive function problem, or is it just another manifestation of a language impairment? Because it's harder for these kids, for example, to remember a list of four words because their semantic representation of those words is weaker, or their phonological representation is weaker. And so we really want to make sure we're, as much as possible, using different types of measures. So we're really feeling confident that we're tapping into the underlying executive function abilities. So then the third component in most of these kind of three component models of executive function would be what's referred to as sometimes shifting, sometimes cognitive flexibility. So in this case, what we're thinking about is moving your attention between either different stimuli or different tasks, or even sometimes just different properties of the stimulus. So a task that I've been using since I was a graduate student to measure this is what we would call the dimensional change card sort task. And here what we're doing is having participants match some cards that have two different characteristics, a shape and a color. First, they match on one dimension. So for example, put the red cards with the red cards and the blue cards with the blue cards. And then after they've done that for a set number of trials, we say, okay, we're done matching by color. Now we're going to match by shape. So now, for example, put the hearts with the hearts and the stars with the stars. But now that means that you're putting opposite colors together. So you're having to stop focusing on color and start focusing on shape. And especially for younger kids, we can really see a clear developmental trajectory where there is a point when children are 3 or 4 that they cannot make this switch. At 4-year-olds, some can, some can't. And by 5, and typically developing populations, that switch is pretty reliable. So we can see a nice development with that.
That reminds me of working with my children on playing the game that we play quite a bit in the U.S. with young children called Uno, where you have to do colors and numbers, and that can be a little tricky.
Yes, yes. Having to shift your attention around and not focus on just one aspect. Yes. So those would be sort of the examples of the components of executive function that are typically measured and talked about, I also like to bring in a fourth component, which is just attention, which is a broader construct. And I do that in part because I think of executive function from a developmental standpoint. And before any of these executive function components are apparent in kids, the first things that we can see in infancy are more general attention abilities. And these seem to really underlie all of these other executive function components. And so if you think about, for example, the working memory task that we did, any of these really, if the child does not have the underlying attention skills to attend to the input, to attend to the task, in the flanker task, it doesn't matter if they are inhibiting the arrows or not, if they're not even attending to the fact that they are doing a task. And so I think because that is kind of, I think of it as sort of the foundation, the starting place of all of these cognitive skills, and then they can all emerge from that broader attention. I also will frequently include measures of something like sustained attention. So how can you attend to a task over time, in addition to these more specific executive function component measures?
And how do you measure attention and sustained attention with these children typically?
So a kind of classic sustained attention task is one that we would call a continuous performance task. So these are often designed to have more trials than we would expect a child of the target age that we're working with to be able to do. So for example, with my preschoolers, these will often be tasks with 100 trials. And anyone who works with preschoolers, that should be kind of setting off an alarm bell that 100 trials is a lot to ask a 4 or 5-year-old to do, but that's by design. And so the idea is that they are looking for or listening for, because again, these can be verbal or nonverbal, a certain target, and they respond in one way in the presence of the target and often withhold a response if it's not there. But again, what we're really interested in is, can they stay engaged in this task over 100 trials? And often what we find is that attention does start to wane over time. So we find that they are starting to miss some target trials more as time goes on, as their attention is kind of fading from the task. And it also gives us some insights into whether or not their attention is more marked by inattention. So are they missing the targets, or is their performance more marked by false alarms? Are they responding more impulsively? And both would be kind of signs of weaker sustained attention. And so that's a way that we could then have that information about our kids as well.
Well, talk about sustained attention. As you're saying this, describing this construct, I'm thinking of my own experiences having done some of these. So I may have missed it. Do you give like animals that they would see across the screen and then hit a space bar or click? Like, what are the exact examples they might see? Because I've seen ones that are more alphabet based, but I assume with preschoolers, you're not using those. So my experience has been like, hit the space bar every time you see an A, and then you just see tons of letters coming up. So what do you use for preschoolers?
Yeah, so we try definitely to make things a little bit more engaging and interesting for preschoolers, because even though we are trying to capture their sustained attention and there should be some element of boringness, essentially, we can't make it too sterile, or we won't even get them to do it from the beginning. So an example of a visual one that I've used in a few studies is one where they see a background image of a farm and different animals pop up on the screen, and they should press the button when they see a pig. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, all of the non-target animals are from a variety of animals. And so they're just looking for that one. So in that way, it's a little bit more visually engaging. And in contrast to your example, it doesn't rely on alphabetic knowledge, right? And something like a pig, is chosen because that's an early acquired word and a concept that, most American preschoolers would be familiar with.
So if they're inattentive, they might not be pushing the button whenever they see a pig. And so they're missing some of them. But if they have more false positives, they might be pushing the button with the pig and the cow, for instance.
Exactly. And so then, you know, we're seeing them. Oftentimes, I think that is not, well, it's hard to say why kids make the errors that they do. That's one of the interesting things with work about working with kids is we're not always sure what's going on, what's motivating them to do that. But my sense is that oftentimes when children are making more false alarms, it's more to almost speed up the task. It's not necessarily that they think that the cow is a pig or that they don't understand. It's more an issue of, I am trying to get through this as fast as possible. So I'm just going to, you know, kind of break the rules and press the button every time because I am being taxed, my attention's being taxed, and I don't want to be doing this anymore, right? Which again is another sign of weaker sustained attention. So they can't stay engaged in the task in an appropriate way as long as other kids who are not making those false alarms.
That makes great sense.
So then more definitions going on to developmental language disorder. Here we're thinking about individuals whose language abilities are below age expectations in the absence of a known cause. So they have normal hearing, for example. They don't have a diagnosis of another developmental disability like autism or Down syndrome, but they tend to, despite this, they have language that does not match their peers. The definition has kind of shifted, or using developmental language disorder creates a different sample of children than we might have had historically when researchers were using the specific language impairment definition. So here we are allowing some other disorders like ADHD. We know from some of Sean Redmond's work, for example, that ADHD and developmental language disorder co-occur frequently. And so that does not necessarily preclude a DLD diagnosis. And we also consider nonverbal IQ, but as long as children are within the kind of non-impaired range, as long as we can rule out an intellectual disability, they can still be included in this group.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I know there's some confusion just in general about the specific language impairment definition versus developmental language disorder. And I have a few episodes, one of them in particular with Dorothy Bishop, which talks about some of the differences between. But I think it's important to note, too, that, as you said, the definition now for DLD doesn't preclude some children that might have been precluded before. Okay. But also, I don't know what your experience has been, but a lot of the studies I've conducted with SLI in the past, we never did exclude children with ADHD anyway. We did capture right. it. We, you know, uh-huh. we didn't measure it, but we didn't exclude it. And then also Spalding 2014, I can link in the references from this episode, she showed like the different nonverbal IQ that's used. And I never used with my colleagues a stringent IQ. So, right. And about 50% of studies did use a less stringent definition of, or IQ for SLI. So even though we have DLD versus SLI, about 50% of the past studies would have counted as the current definition of DLD. So, and the other ones really don't differ by much. So it's kind of interesting to think through that because I know that as we have to reconcile past literature,
right,
it's really tricky, but there are some nuances there that that showcase the fact that a lot of those studies did qualify as the current definition of DLD. So I think that's kind of something that I just wanted to pause and mention as you talked about, even with the ADHD, for instance.
Right.
I think in some ways, with the DLD definition, some people have said we've become more lenient, but I've noticed we might even be thinking more deeply about what we're including
right.
In terms of comorbidities. And I think, you know, you're mentioning that with ADHD.
Right. Thank you for those points because they're great because I too was previously publishing, describing my sample as having SLI. For me, working with 4 and 5 year olds, most of those kids are not going to have an ADHD diagnosis. So that's something that we've always asked about, but I don't know that I have yet encountered a participant who actually already has that diagnosis. So that was not as much of an issue, but I was allowing kids with IQs down as low as 75 in my samples. And so what I think is nice is that now it's just very it's more transparent. Yes. Now, and I hope that it makes a little bit more consistency. Again, so we can understand how we can compare across studies. Are we really talking about the same kids? Which is, you know, really, really important. So, so when we're working with kids with developmental language disorder and thinking about executive function, the reason that I think that this population is so interesting for this is because I remember as a student learning about these people, of course, at the time we were using SLI, as kind of an example of how we can see that language and cognition are separate. Because here you have individuals with language impairments, but without cognitive impairments. And so it's an argument for language and cognitive systems being separate. And then there's literature coming out at the time as I was in graduate school. And as people are looking at cognition differently, not just thinking about a global IQ score, but looking at more specific cognitive abilities, that's when we start to see that there are some differences in the samples with language disorder in terms of lower executive function abilities. And so I think it's kind of interesting because it speaks to this bigger theoretical question of, is language a totally separate system from cognition? And, you know, now I think that separation is much less clear because depending on how you measure cognition, you can start to find some evidence that individuals with language impairment don't have a truly typical cognitive system as well.
What are some of the major findings that you have from this line of study? Because it's so important to really think through some of the details. And now that we have the definitions in our mind and have a really good sense, thank you, of how these are measured, I'd love to hear more about your findings.
Right. So one of the sort of first areas of inquiry as I started to move from working with only typical kids into including kids with language impairment into my work was really just getting a sense of how do children with developmental language disorder compare to their typical peers across these different components of executive function, as well as looking both verbally and non-verbally at these components. So as a postdoc in Dr. Elena Plant's lab, I was able to conduct some work looking at measuring executive function, all the three components that I mentioned before, working memory, inhibition, and cognitive flexibility, in a sample of preschoolers with typical language and with DLD. And each of those was measured with a nonverbal task and with a verbal task. And so then we can get this bigger sense of whether or not we can find evidence of executive function deficits, even if we measure something nonverbally. If we can't, that takes us back to the issue that we discussed earlier, that it might be that when people are reporting EF deficits, it's really because they measured executive function in a language heavy way. And so kids with developmental language disorder are just performing poorly on the task because it's also a language task. And so from that study, we found that we could see reliable differences between the groups. Across all the components of executive function, the group with developmental language disorder had significantly lower performance compared to their typical peers. And we could see it both on our verbal and nonverbal tasks, although perhaps not surprisingly, the group differences were bigger when we used a verbal task. So that's kind of, you know, not surprising again, because we know that they have language impairment. And so that's an important caveat and something to keep in mind as you think about this relationship. I think we have evidence that they have executive function deficits, the kids with developmental language disorder, but we should also expect that to interact with their language, with their language disorder, to see even bigger deficits. And I think that has important implications, not only for research, but also just for how we think about these kids functioning in their everyday lives, because then we can think about how things like hearing verbal instructions in a classroom could be especially challenging for these kids. If it's multi-step instructions that are presented verbally, they are then having to address the issue that understanding the instructions might be harder for them, but then also recalling those instructions in the correct order and executing them is hard for them. And so we can imagine scenarios where this kind of combined deficit of language and executive function can make things really challenging for these kids, especially in educational settings.
Yeah, that, I think that's a really important observation that you're making with this research, because oftentimes we think about the connections between working memory and language. As researchers, it makes good sense to us that we would say, okay, you know, we're mitigating some of our working memory through language, and some work showing that language, as language skills develop, working memory develops, and vice versa, so that it is intertwined. However, as you mentioned, I mean, this idea that language, the language difficulties are unique, that's also, I think, important for the definition, but also for maybe at the identity of those who listen, who have developmental language disorder, because that, you know, as you know, and I'm sure you've thought very deeply about, is that these labels can be something that provides you support that you need, or it can be something that can lower expectations. Uh-huh. And so I definitely can see how this can be taken out of both lenses, but I appreciate that you're taking it right to the lens of support, because it's not that you're saying that these children don't have the working memory skills to improve. It's that you're saying that these children and adults could benefit from some support in both language, but then that language support does not ignore the way that it's delivered, for instance.
Exactly.
You know, step directions. So as we're working towards improving language skills, also acknowledging the working memory aspects that could improve with support, but also could hinder the ability to take in the language information we're trying to improve. So I really appreciate thinking through all of those components.
And that brings me to another kind of small scale study that I did, because I was interested in how we could potentially improve executive function performance in children with developmental language disorder. And so I turned to the literature on children with typical development. And using that card sort test that I mentioned earlier, as I said, most three-year-olds fail. So there's actually a little bit of a literature where researchers from developmental psychology are looking for ways to get the three-year-olds to pass that, to make the switch. And so they have different versions of the task that offer additional support. And they've shown a few different ways that you can actually get three-year-olds to switch before developmentally we would expect them to. So I wondered if we could apply a couple of those techniques to our older kids with DLD who are 4 and 5 and still failing to switch. So in this study, I gave the card sort to participants with developmental language disorder and only continued working with kids who failed to make the switch. So I knew that they were not going to make the switch on their own. And so then after a delay, I gave them another version of the card sort. And it was one of two different versions that, again, both had been shown to improve performance in typically developing three-year-olds. One was one in which the children label the relevant dimension of the card. So in the standard administration, the experimenter labels the relevant dimension. So if we were doing the color card sorting, for example, after reminding them that blue ones go here and red ones go here, as I give them the next card, I would say this is a red one. So I'm labeling the red for them. But in this manipulation, you have the children label it. The idea being that hearing that having to produce the label themselves makes it more meaningful for them and actually draws their attention to that characteristic more than hearing you say it. So now you're handing them you're saying red ones go here, blue ones go here. What color is this one? You have them label it and then they sort it. So it's a way of, again, trying to use their own language to focus their attention a little bit more. The other condition was one where after we've done one version of the card sort, so for example, we finish the entire color game, typically what happens is everything, all of the boxes and the cards stay in front of them and you just verbally tell them, okay, we're all done with the color game. Let's play a new game. This is called the shape game. In this really subtle manipulation, what you do is take the lids and put them back on the boxes that the cards are going to go in and create this more visual shift. So you put the lids back on the boxes and then you take them off as you're telling them we're playing a new game. So it adds this additional cue that something is changing. And what's interesting is it's a nonverbal cue that shows children, in addition to your instructions, that there's something happening here at this point. And so what I found, and again, this is a small study, so we would need to explore this with a larger sample to see if the results hold, but the children with DLD did not benefit from the labeling. That did not change their performance, but they did benefit from that really subtle visual cue of a switch. And so I think going back to the idea of support, this is great evidence that, emerging evidence that we'll again need to look more into in the future of ways that just changing the environment slightly can really benefit the executive function performance of these kids. And so going back to multi-step directions and all of the potential challenges, if that's accompanied by a visual schedule that has pictures, for example, that can really provide that additional support that could help these kids, again, in real life settings, because we can see that they can use those supports, but having them use language as a strategy or a support may not be as beneficial as using nonverbal supports.
Oh, Leah, this is so cool and such a powerful finding. I know you said it's preliminary, but it's such a great example too of tying a really clear theory and that has been worked out with children who are typically developing. And then you've really taken that multidisciplinary lens and you're pulling in that work from developmental psychology into communication sciences and disorders, trying it out with those children who have a developmental language disorder, and then seeing what really works and highlighting the multiple possibilities that maybe speech language pathologists are using now, like, verbal rehearsal versus the cueing that's nonverbal. And you're really showcasing one does appear to be better than the other. And I think that's so important when we think about the link between research and practice and how to make more direct kind of conclusions from research. So I really appreciate that. I've often thought myself as someone who studies language interventions, a lot of times what we find is our language interventions just throw more language at a child who has language difficulties, as opposed to really trying to think through multi-sensory approaches that have been found to be helpful with other children as well. Like children who have dyslexia, for instance, showing that multiple cue sources, but you're really honing in on the cue that works the best.
Right.
So important.
So then thinking kind of broadly about what my research goals are. So as I mentioned, I got really interested in developmental language disorder because I am interested in that underlying relationship, language and cognition. Is language separate? Is it, could we go as far as to say they're the same thing? Does one influence the other? And so in my lab, our research really takes what I would describe as a bi-directional view, where we think of how language influences cognition, but also how cognitive skills may be involved in language acquisition. So for example, thinking about how cognition relates to language, I've collaborated with one of our recently graduated doctoral students, Jesse Erickson, on some research looking at novel word learning in preschoolers with DLD and with typical development. And we have our executive function measures on these kids as well. And we're looking at what predicts their word learning outcomes from our executive function measures. And from that, we found that both short-term memory and inhibition are predictive of word learning in these populations, which again, I think makes some sense, right? When we're thinking about what it takes to acquire a new word, you're having to remember the phonological form, you're having to remember its new, you know, the referent that it's matched with, depending on how we're measuring their knowledge. And so all of it's nice to think about how cognition plays a role in that, right? And so we do have some of that evidence in our lab that those things, those skills are related. And I know that some of your work with working memory, you know, with some older kids shows similar findings that we can't totally separate out executive function from language in that way.
That's very exciting too, to think about the multiple levers you can push. If it's bidirectional, you know, improving on language skills could in turn improve on executive function, working memory, and the cognition, cognitive abilities that you're mentioning, and then vice versa. That's very exciting to consider both of those.
Yes. And I love that kind of viewpoint of, instead of thinking about it from a deficit model of, oh, that means if you have executive function deficits, you're going to have language deficits and vice versa. It really is an opportunity, right? So if we can improve this area, we could kind of also see gains in another and get more bang for our buck in that way. So I love that framework, that framing of it.
Yeah, that makes great sense. I know I have a study that builds on a lot of work around orthographic facilitation, where with older children, if you're teaching a new word, they'll remember the phonological or the sounds if you are pairing those sounds with letters at the same time of exposure, which I think is linked to, you know, I mentioned it, kind of that nonverbal aspect. It gives a visual cue to the sounds. And so I think it ties really nicely together with what you're describing, because that work has shown the benefit of that orthographic facilitation for many groups of children who have known working memory deficits. So it's very, I think that I agree that the message here is less about deficit and more about multiple levers to pull and considerations, and how improving one can improve the other and vice versa, which in turn improves function, as you've mentioned.
Right. So we've also looked at the opposite direction. So how is language playing a role in executive function performance? And initially, this was really more observational. So we had videos, recordings of kids doing some of our different tasks. And we started with the continuous performance task, which is the sustained attention task that I mentioned before, with the animals. And just from having administered that task to kids, I noticed some kids are talking a lot, and some kids are doing this totally silently. And so that's a great example of when we measure something non-verbally, it's all images. Some participants may be treating it truly non-verbally and not using language to mediate the task at all, but others might be heavily relying on language to mediate the task. And so we use those video data. Another one of the doctoral students here at the University of Arizona, Heidi Mettler, and I looked back at the video data to see, and this was only in children with developmental language disorder. So we were looking at the differences in how much kids were talking about the task. And we also categorized what language they were using. So is it about the task? Is it something that's strategic? And what we mean by that is it mediating their response at all? So an example of a strategic verbalization during that task where the target is a pig is saying, "It's a pig," before they press the button, or saying, "Not a pig," when they see the cow. They could also be talking about the task, but in a non-strategic way. So things like, this is fun, or more often, are we almost done, right? And so commenting on the task, but not in the strategic way. And so we were interested in whether or not the use of that strategic speech was related to their performance on the task. And we did find that among our kids with developmental language disorder, those who were using more strategic speech had better accuracy scores on the task. So they were less likely to have these misses and false alarms. And so that was showing that their language was in some ways mediating their attention performance. And what was interesting about that study is it was really naturalistic. We did not give kids instructions as to talk or not talk. And so we were just capturing what they were doing in that scenario. They were all in the same scenario, and some used overt language and others didn't. But we also saw huge amounts of variability. Like I said, in the same sample, if you look at the transcript, some have nothing in the transcript. The child just silently did the task, and others, they are saying something on every trial. So there seems to be a lot of variation in kids with language impairment in terms of how much, at least overt, self-directed speech. So self-directed speech is, again, this speech that's to yourself, that's meant not social. It's not intended to be shared with a listener, but it's to yourself. And typically what we think of it doing is as mediating your thinking and behavior in some way. So kind of talking yourself through something.
Seems like that would have some real interesting clinical and theoretical implications. Yes. Can you talk through that a bit?
Yeah. So an open question. And whenever I talk with clinicians about this, they always ask, should we be encouraging self-talk or self-directed speech in our kids with language impairment then? And my answer at this point, unfortunately, is I don't know, because what we were looking at there was the naturalistic use. So these were kids who have decided upon this as a strategy on their own. And what we don't know is if we give them the strategy, if it will be as beneficial. On the one hand, it might help. It might be that the kids who were doing the task silently, had we given them that tool in their toolbox, they would have used it and it would have improved their performance. But it might also be that for those kids, it may be distracting. It may not be something that they're ready to use. And so having them do that could actually make their performance worse, because they're going along doing a non-linguistic task and we make them use language, which is an area of challenge for them. And so right now, I'm not totally sure. I have recently have started a new study. So I have some NIH early career R21 funding to actually look exactly at this question. So now we are bringing kids in and having them do a planning executive function task. And we have them do it 4 times, and we are manipulating how they're doing it to see if changing their self-directed speech changes their performance. We're doing this with kids with and without developmental language disorder. So the first time they do the puzzle, we just give them the standard instructions. Again, we're trying to capture what is the naturalistic use of self-directed speech across these two populations of preschoolers. And then in a randomized order, they do 3 different other conditions meant to either increase or decrease self-directed speech. So in one that we call the plan aloud condition, we tell them, okay, now when you do the puzzle, tell us out loud how you're solving the puzzle as you do it. And so we're really encouraging this talking through the puzzle. And then we have another condition, which is called articulatory suppression. And what that means is we're having them say something irrelevant so they can't talk through the task. And the nice thing about this is that we're preventing them from talking both aloud, but also internally. So we know that as children age, their self-directed speech becomes internalized. It's almost an internal voice talking to yourself. is saying things out loud. And the challenge of that is we can't capture that on our videos. So they might be doing it internally and we wouldn't see it. And so this is preventing both. So if their performance gets worse in this condition, then it's a sign that using self-directed speech is beneficial because preventing them from doing it makes it worse. So just to give an example, what they're doing now is doing a puzzle. It's moving discs on pegs in the Tower of Hanoi puzzle. And now they have to say apple over and over again the whole time they're doing it. So they can't be talking about the task anymore. And then we have a fourth condition. And this one is really just meant to show that if there are changes in performance related to our articulatory suppression condition, it really is about the language and not just about dual task. So in this condition, it's a foot tapping condition. So while they're doing the puzzle, they're tapping their foot. So we're asking them to do something else. But if tapping their foot doesn't change their performance in the same way that articulatory suppression does, then we have more confidence that it really is about the manipulation of the self-directed speech that changes the performance and not just the additional burden of, hey, while you're doing this already tricky puzzle, also remember to do something else.
Oh, that's so cool. Such interesting manipulations that I've been, you know, as a researcher, I've tried myself. It's really tricky. I remember doing something where, yes, I was like, I know I'm a visual person, I don't care. And then I had to say the word and over and over, which is another manipulation you see, especially in adult studies. And I found that to be very difficult. And I thought I was mediating with language, but I was clearly mediating with language. So these tests are so fascinating, I think, to get to individual differences in children and how these unique manipulations, which are, you know, there are laboratory manipulations, but they I think they really do represent a lot what could happen functionally with a child, right?
And right,
that too, whether it's being distracted by talking, you know, to others, or a lot of talk around them, which probably is very difficult, or and which we see in the classroom a lot and
right,
school environments, or even if it's, you know, fidgeting or something like that, that is whether self-driven or maybe they're doing it as they're told to do something else. It makes a lot of sense to me.
Right.
And I really appreciate you doing that work.
So hopefully we will have an answer soon, you know, at the pace of research, for whether or not asking children to use self-directed speech, especially if we go back and look at what they did in the standard condition, if we see a child who's not talking when we don't tell them to, who then talks when we have them in that condition, if we see improvement, that, you know, is the kind of evidence that we would need to then encourage clinicians, for example, to potentially target self-directed speech as a target in therapy.
And you're really getting at the complexity, because a lot of times interventions are, you know, a lot of times, unfortunately, by necessity, they're one size fits all, meaning that you need to get, you know, people trained up on them. But you're really getting at nuances and individual differences that could emerge from the child that drives the intervention.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's something moving forward as we think more about, you know, more broadly about the idea of precision medicine, I think that's kind of what we need to start to think about. And of course, as someone who doesn't do intervention work, it's very easy for me to put the burden on the people who are doing the intervention work. But I think, you know, when we look at interventions, even effective ones are often not effective for 100% of the participants. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about how can we tailor this to individual participants, individual children, to help them get the most out of it. I think that's something that will be important moving forward once, you know, of course we have to move in the order of things where we establish that an intervention is effective in the first place, but then thinking more about how it can be maximally effective is an important consideration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. The tying personalized medicine with adaptive interventions. I think that there's going to be some advances in that way. So I typically ask two final questions, but is that study the thing you're most interested in, or did you have something else that you are most interested in right now or most excited about that you're working on?
So that study, the new one is currently the thing that I'm most excited about, because it's, you know, we're just starting out. So the questions are really unanswered, which is always a fun part of the research process to be in when you've had this idea and you're finally getting to actually put it into place. Another part of that study, kind of a side question that I am also really interested in and seeing how it plays out, is different ways to measure executive function. So when I was defining executive function and talking about how we measure it, those were all what we would call performance-based tasks. So it's how does the person do on a task that has been developed to tap into this skill. But there's also report-based measures of executive function. And what I mean by this is the individual themselves, although with preschoolers, it's not going to be a self-rating, but parents or teachers answering questions about functional executive function. So, you know, for older kids, do they forget their homework? A lot, sometimes, never. How often is this a problem? Do they follow directions? Things like that. So it's more how are they functioning in daily life? And what's interesting is that from other populations, we've seen that these types of measures, performance-based and report-based, don't necessarily correlate. And so as part of this study, because I am getting performance-based measures on all of our kids, I'm also having the parents give us some performance-based information, report-based information, so we can compare whether or not these different approaches to executive function are yielding similar results in samples of children with developmental language disorder. And just moving forward, thinking about research, I have typically used performance-based measures in my work on executive function, but I think it's really important to try to integrate both when it's feasible, because I think that we are getting different but valid information from both. So I think we get a more holistic picture of executive functioning when we can both test it directly and get parent reports. So that's a little side project within this bigger project that I'm actually also really excited about.
I'm so glad you're doing that work, because you know, oftentimes the diagnosis of ADHD comes from those parent and teacher reports. Uh-huh. And yet so much research is done on the child's individual differences in these executive functioning tasks. And there's a gap there. And
right.
You are really able to bridge that gap and maybe even create an early warning sign. Maybe you're seeing some things that are happening in executive functioning through your individualized tasks that aren't showing functionally yet, so uh-huh. time factor, or that you're seeing some things that aren't captured, you know, on the individual assessments you're giving that are captured functionally. So I think your whole world is bidirectionality now.
Yes.
Which we know that's what's happening anyway, all over the place. Right. I appreciate that you're leaning in to that complexity, because that's what's going to help drive, I think, the field forward, because we're often thinking about diagnostic categories as opposed to these individual differences and nuances that you are studying. So that's a great way to bridge the gap there, I think, for our listeners who are maybe wondering, you know, how does this relate to ADHD and early ADHD versus later diagnosed ADHD and language impairment? And it's really complicated, and you're just digging right into it. So that's very exciting. And congratulations on the funding.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes.
That's really what you need, is the funding to
yes.
get done. Well, we'll be hanging on your every finding and have you come back as you continue to more directly specify the relationship between executive functioning and developmental language disorder. My last question I ask guests are, what is your favorite book from childhood or now?
So I thought about this a lot, and I am going to give you two answers. Both are children's books. And one is my favorite book from my own childhood, which was the book Katie No Pocket by Emmy Payne. And that I don't know that many other people read that as a kid. It's a story about a mom kangaroo who doesn't have a pocket. And so she is seeing other animals carrying their babies and is feeling sad about it. And then she meets a handyman who gives her his apron full of pockets. And then she's able to carry her Joey and all of the other animals.
That's amazing. And
a touching story.
It's like a direct link from your childhood favorite book to what you do now to support children. That's so amazing.
And then my favorite book to read to my own kids when they were littler is Harold and the Purple Crayon. So that was my favorite bedtime story. I don't know if it was their favorite, but that was my favorite one to read.
Yeah, all the creativity involved. Why did you
like it? Yeah, so I just, you know, I loved some of the wording in it. I thought it was really, I just thought the wording was very clever and a little bit complex for kids sometimes, but within the context of a pretty simple and imaginative story. So I just really liked that juxtaposition.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know, it is. Some people tell me it's the hardest question I ask is the big book. So I get it. It's hard to choose just one. Even on my lab website, everyone chooses a favorite book, but I've taken the kind of a veto card of like, nope, I'm not going to choose.
Right.
So I'm asking everyone else, but sadly it's hard. It's a hard one. So I empathize with that. Well, Leah, thank you so much for your time today. It's been great to bring your work to life through this discussion and share it broadly with our listeners.
Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity and for the fun conversation. I really appreciate it.
Check out www.seehearspeakpodcast.com for helpful resources associated with this podcast, including, for example, the podcast transcript, research articles, and speaker bios. You can also sign up for email alerts on the website or subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or any other listening platform so you can be the first to hear about new episodes. Thank you for listening and good luck to you, making the world a better place by helping one child at a time.